supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In advance of New Jersey Governor-elect Phil Murphy swearing in next Tuesday, Governor Chris Christie today delivered his eighth and final State of the State address. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Let's make sense of Christie's speech with Dr. Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. Professor, thanks for joining us once again on NewsWorks Tonight.
My pleasure, Dave.
Well, this almost sounded like a speech from someone who's running for office. It was lots of positives.
It almost sounded like Chris Christie back in 2010. And I think that if this were the gentleman who would have stayed in this mode, who would have kept his bipartisanship, his grace, his dignity, perhaps we'd be talking about a different outcome right now. But this was the Chris Christie that I think many New Jerseyans put their hope and their faith in and, you know, really turned to back in the darkest times in New Jersey economically recently, and who seemed to kind of metamorphosize before our eyes into something that we really didn't like.
Certainly validated in recent and indeed the most recent poll, which finds his approval rating pretty abysmal.
Record low. And this is something that perhaps really materialized in the aftermath of the Bridgegate scandal, but was really something that was brewing for quite some time and reflected a dissatisfaction on the part of many New Jerseyans with his tenure in office, particularly in handling the economy, but also the kind of public persona that he had become. Rather than one like today, we heard him quoting Tennyson and reaching across the aisle and congratulating some of the Democratic leaders with whom he worked. We saw episodes of him bullying public employees and shouting down constituents on the boardwalk. And those kind of behaviors really led many New Jerseyans to regard him disfavorably.
I believe the closest he came to conceding misgivings was acknowledging that sometimes the office was a lonely place to be. On the flip side, this is what the governor regarded as his greatest accomplishment. Let's listen.
Whenever I'm asked what I'm most proud of in these last 8 years, I say it very simply. It's the days and weeks, months and years since Sandy and the way our government handled it. The results were not always perfect. You know, they never are perfect. But I'll tell you what was perfect. The effort, the compassion, and the focus.
Given a bit to hyperbole, but Professor, do you think that's largely substantiated in the months and years ahead?
Well, I think that he may regard that as his greatest achievement. I think that that's an interesting choice simply because if you think back to that time, that was when he was perhaps at one of the pinnacles of both his popularity, his success, and renown nationally. But if you talk to people nationally, particularly Republicans who are active in the National Republican Party, that episode, the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy, was really viewed by many as the beginning of his downfall politically. That is, his behaviors in that time may have been what cost him the presidential nomination. Many people perceived that his kind of relationship with President Obama and his congratulatory tone with President Obama slighted Mitt Romney, perhaps cost Mitt Romney the presidency, but in any way was viewed as rather treacherous.
Although, might you agree, though, that ultimately what cost him his aspirations on the national stage were A, Bridgegate, and B, his affiliation with Kushner Sr.?
Well, I don't know that primary voters in New Hampshire and Iowa were enormously concerned about Bridgegate. I think that, that perhaps contributed. I think that the biggest thing that contributed to his inability to gain traction was the presence of Donald Trump in the race. Donald Trump out-Chris Christie'd Chris Christie. He became the tell-it-like-it-is politician and kind of stole his M.O. and his thunder.
Does the broom sweep clean, or in any sense, does Phil Murphy come in playing off of what was left behind by Christie?
Oh, I think that there are There is no broom in the state of New Jersey. And I think that the biggest pile of dust that Governor Murphy-elect will have to deal with, if we want to carry this metaphor further, is the looming pension crisis. It's costing the state of New Jersey about $10 million a day. It is something that will have to be dealt with. Right now, Governor-elect Murphy has very good relationships with the leadership in the public employee unions. We'll see if he's able to retain those relationships when he's sitting on the other side of the negotiating table.
Well, then we in turn will look forward to having you back no later than next year to assess then Governor Murphy's first State of the State address.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you for joining us. That's Dr. Bridget Harrison, professor of political science and law at Montclair State University. Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner is defending his decision last week to fire 31 prosecutors. He spoke to reporters for more than an hour this afternoon about his effort to take city's top law enforcement agency in a new direction. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports.
Krasner explained his decision this way.
The coach gets to pick the team. It doesn't necessarily mean that players who are traded are bad players. Some of them might be. Some of them might be great players who simply do not fit into the strategy of the team and the success they are trying to have.
The DA says the employee job interviews were not formal. They came from his and other people's experience with the people in and out of the courtroom.
In every single instance, we had multiple sources and multiple incidents coming from different sides, defense and prosecution, or the judiciary, plus my own experience, plus something else, that drew us to the conclusion the individual was better served working elsewhere.
Krasner, a former civil rights attorney, has promised to be a different kind of DA, one that bucks the traditional message of law and order. He says he's working to restructure the office to align with his priorities, including ending cash bail and providing treatment for drug users over imprisonment.
So we are making every effort to minimize those bumps in the road, but the reality is when you have a change of culture, when you have a reorganization, there are going to be some bumps in the road, and it's our job to minimize them.
The new DA says his supervisor appointments are all interim and could be subject to change, giving no one job security in the hierarchy of his office.
As life moves on, there will be others asked to resign, not in any particular big wave that we can anticipate at this time, but this is normal supervision. When people are acting in ways that are not consistent with the mission of the office, that's what happens. That's called supervision.
Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
No place in Pennsylvania has a formal agreement to work with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Under what's called a 287G agreement, local officers are deputized to do work that ICE normally performs. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports that Bensalem Township in Bucks County hopes to be the first on board over objections from some community members.
Director of Public Safety Fred Heron has been with the Bensalem Police Department for about 30 years. He says in the past, the department had a 287G agreement, allowing local police to vet and detain people suspected of being in the country illegally.
We were working very aggressively with immigration, and then the Obama administration put a halt on it.
In 2012, the U.S. scaled back but didn't end the program in favor of other kinds of collaboration with local police. Under President Trump, Heron wants police in Bensalem to officially work alongside immigration enforcement again.
We're not a sanctuary city. So if you commit a crime in Bensalem and you're in this country illegally, you can rest assured I'm going to use that tool to stop you from committing crime tomorrow.
He says helping ICE deport undocumented immigrants charged with crimes is one of those tools. But community activist Teresa Conejo and other critics are concerned that this kind of cooperation will lead to distrust between immigrant communities and local law enforcement.
We don't think it's a good fit for Bensalem. We really don't think that the rate of violent crimes by undocumented people in Bensalem is that high that it would warrant it.
Conejo is pushing for public debate on the proposal and plans to bring it up at the next township council meeting. As for timing, Heron says ICE hasn't given the township a green light yet, so it's not clear when an agreement could start to take shape. Currently, two counties in South Jersey have 287G agreements. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Delaware and New Jersey are on notice as the Trump administration intends to allow new offshore oil and gas drilling in nearly all United States coastal waters. Let's consider implications with University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean and Environment Professor Jeremy Firestone. Professor, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Well, thank you for having me.
So for starters, distinguish our region's ocean and coastal zones with that of the Gulf Coast, where predominantly all the oil drilling is being conducted now.
The Gulf Coast is certainly well stocked with reserves of oil and gas. Much less is known off the Atlantic coast as far as oil and gas reserves. And indeed, there may not be much available at an economic price. So that's sort of the biggest difference there. The other sort of large difference is that we've got a very gently sloping continental shelf with strong winds, which is really ideal for offshore wind power. The winds are much less in the Gulf. So offshore wind can be a big part of the energy portfolio for the East Coast states, where oil and gas works pretty well for the Gulf Coast.
We're not talking about the potential to see oil wells off the shore in a year or two or even five, I presume.
I think that is correct. We're looking long down the road. We may have another administration in place by that time. They may have different views. So policy can change over time, just like it changed from the Obama administration to the Trump administration. And again, you need oil companies to make decisions to go and bid on areas, and they have to make a determination that there's going to be economically extractable oil. And it's not clear that there's going to be bidders either, particularly in a context where we're at comparatively to, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, low oil prices.
That calculus might also be predicated in part on what you suggest as the volatility of the decision-making, where now much of the Obama legacy in this regard is being undone and then can be reversed yet again in subsequent administrations.
That is correct. There is some protection to oil companies once they bid and they pay a upfront bonus payment as far as getting those payments back if the federal government were to cancel. But it's a lengthy process. So at this point, all they did is say, we're looking at these big, large areas. They haven't really set forth any leases. After leases, there's a number of steps, including exploration, before you get to development. And there's a number of opportunities under both the Coastal Zone Management Act for states to engage and under the National Environmental Policy Act for both states and members of the public to engage on this topic.
I was trying to, on my own, determine how many miles of coastline is represented by each state, and there are at least two different ways of calculating. One really refers specifically to ocean coastline, and then another also includes tidal inlets, and that calculation is more than 10 times the original length. Are tidal inlets part of this ecology as well?
They certainly could come into play. Obviously, if you have an oil spill, oil could move up the Delaware Bay or into the inland bays of Delaware. So those are issues that states would be concerned with. Probably a larger focus of the attention is going to be on the ocean coastline because it's the part that's most likely to be impacted. And it has the largest economic value to states as far as tourism and commercial fishermen as well.
I presume tourists and fishermen are pretty much in lockstep against this proposal.
I would guess so, but I haven't really heard much from the commercial fishing industry yet on the proposal, and even not so much from citizens yet. Most of the dialogue that I've heard has either come from states or members of Congress.
Professor Firestone, thanks for joining us to lend insight.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Professor Jeremy Firestone, University of Delaware College of Earth, Ocean, and Environment. Choice is a bedrock of Philadelphia's education system. Few cities in the nation offer parents more options for where to send their kids. Charter schools, magnet schools, and private schools garner most of the attention and debate. But there's another form of school choice that's growing under the radar. WHYY's Avi Wolfman-Arad explains.
All right, hold on a minute. Let the car warm up for 1 minute.
Waliyuddin Abdullah and his first grader, Flory, have a morning ritual. On the daily drive from their North Philadelphia home to Flory's school in West Philly, they whip out a set of flashcards with words Flory is learning to read.
Center. What's a center?
Every time Flory masters 200 new words, she gets a prize, though not the American Girl doll she wants.
Something reasonable. And
I
know.
After 15 or 20 minutes, depending on traffic, the Abdullah Mobile pulls up to Samuel Powell School, just north of Drexel University. The Powell schoolyard is packed with kids playing kickball and, more notably, lots of doting parents.
When the bell's going to ring in about 1 minute. And you'll see the students, see how they're playing there? They all will stop and start going to line up. The bulk, I mean the overwhelming bulk of these children, all want to learn. That makes a difference.
Who are we? Why are we here? What will we do?
This is why Abdullah sends Flory to Powell. It's a safe school with good academics and involved parents. Abdullah's home school in North Philadelphia has some of the city's lowest test scores. When people from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos on down extol the virtues of school choice, this is the scene they often paint, of a dad from a struggling neighborhood getting a shot at something better for his daughter. But Powell isn't some specialized magnet school or charter. The schools DeVos and her allies tend to highlight. Powell is what most people call a traditional public school that takes kids from the surrounding neighborhood, or catchment. What distinguishes Powell is that nearly two-thirds of the kids are like Flory. They come from outside the catchment.
And the wait list, year after year, grows.
Kim Ellerby is Powell's principal.
So I believe last year we had over 100 students on the wait list.
Though it gets less publicity than charter schools, Philly's school district has its own internal school choice system. If a neighborhood school has open seats, parents from outside the area can line up to take them, but only if they can provide their own transportation. Unlike charters, these kids don't get bused.
There may be some families that are discouraged by that, but there are definitely families that are motivated enough to say, I don't care, I'll get on the train and I'll make it there. I'll get on the trolley and I'll make it there.
Leaving your neighborhood school is really common at the high school level, but movement even at the lowest grades in Philly seems to be growing. WHYY dug into the data from every neighborhood elementary and middle school and found that 1 in 5 kids at these schools is now from outside the catchment. That's up 5% in 5 years. And at some neighborhood schools, well over half of students aren't from the neighborhood anymore. So is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Or is it something else?
I think differently about it every time I think about it, truly.
Katie McGrath is a parent and public school advocate in Northwest Philadelphia. She sends her kids out of catchment to J.S. Jenks in Chestnut Hill, but she still sees big problems with the system. First, it's only available to families who can afford transportation.
Especially if you're working like 2 hourly wage jobs, you're not going to be able to come to a home and school night on a Wednesday if you're living on the other side of the city.
And while schools like Powell benefit from the influx of new families, those families leave behind neighborhood schools that could use them. Think back to that first scene of Waliyuddin Abdullah and his daughter doing flashcards on their morning drive. Abdullah's North Philly neighborhood school would probably love to have a parent as involved and motivated as he is, but he's taking his energies to West Philly every morning.
It has a comparable effect to kids going to charters or going to private school, as it deprives the school of engaged families, of resources, of, you know, butts in the seats.
We have one system with 2 systems in it.
That's Sylvia Sims, a school choice advocate and former member of the City School Reform Commission.
And I believe that this, we need to stop that.
She lives in North Philadelphia, and her neighborhood school is T.M. Pierce. At Pierce, test scores are low, and Sims says the families that stay often don't know they have other options. She thinks the solution is to open up choice even more, make sure every parent has the knowledge and access the Abdullahs have. But that would further weaken the very concept of schools as neighborhood hubs. And as Katie McGrath says, it could increase the divide between haves and have-nots.
There's no good answer. I mean, there probably is a good answer, but smarter people than me should be working on it.
What's clear is that more parents in Philadelphia are choosing, using every avenue available to them. The task for Philadelphia's school leaders is to find some solution for the schools and families left behind. Avi Wolf-Manarant, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.